Hello and welcome to another edition of the Capital Notes podcast for the beginning of April. And we start with some breaking news. Britney Spears has thrown her hat into the ring for the 4th Congressional District seat vacated by John Doolittle. Anthony, your thoughts?
I think she'll be a strong conservative contender in the race and certainly has better hair than anybody else in the race.
And apparently, you know, changing hair. As we've seen, a lot of different hairstyles.
Yeah,
she's pledging fiscal prudence, I believe, and pushing some paparazzi laws. I believe she's looking at.
Yeah, and I think that you know, obviously, Tom McClintock is very worried, as is Doug Ossie. We'll see who she drains more votes from in the primary.
Baby, hit me one more time.
Okay.
And that was the lamest attempt at the beginning of an April Fool's podcast. I didn't even tell Anthony we were doing it.
No.
I just. You know, that's called ad-lib.
Oh, wait, you mean she's not running? Did she drop out? I don't know.
Well, you know, her campaign manager's mum on the subject today. That's Anthony York from Capital Weekly, and I'm John Myers from KQED. And yes, please bear with us. It was bad, but, you know, you got to try something. And I struggled to think what it would be before.
But as bad as that was, it was perhaps a worse weekend for Carol Migden.
And we'll get to and it's a perfect segue into the weekend past in the California Democratic Party state convention, which was held in San Jose, and various and sundry little tidbits of things to talk about there. But Anthony alluded to one of them. Let's talk about it. The saga, the drama continues in the race for the third Senate district primary race between Carol Migden, the incumbent Democrat from San Francisco, Mark Leno, an assembly member from San Francisco, and Joe Nation, a former assembly member from Marin County. And describe it for people who didn't know. There was quite a bit of a fracas at the convention.
Yeah, it was essentially a floor fight over whether or not Migden would get the endorsement. She had been recommended to receive the endorsement at a pre-convention endorsement meeting, and it was successfully blocked this weekend in what apparently was a very spirited, to put it mildly, debate on the convention floor. You know, what this all means for the real world or for the Democratic primary in June remains to be seen, but it really was an attempt by Migden to sort of to put down a marker sort of as a show of force in the race, and it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's a good sign for Leno or for Nation, what that means in terms of real votes come the first Tuesday in June remains to be seen.
And I have to say, not having been at the meeting where the most controversial kind of thing happened, but you watch the video on the internet and some of the Democratic blogs, the folks over at Calitix and others have blogged about it and showed the little clip of video. Was not Senator Migden's finest moment. It didn't look like when she was kind of getting, you know, kind of jostled a little bit by the crowd and she yelled back at them. And it just, I don't know. I think it just showed. It's a very tense, tight race there. And there's a lot of hard feelings, it seems like.
Yeah. I mean, this has been a bloody battle from the start and, you know, pitting a sitting senator against a sitting assemblyman. And, you know, both from San Francisco, and San Francisco politics is kind of a blood sport to begin with. Mix that in with a contested Senate race, and you had the Full Employment Act for the San Francisco press corps.
So. and if there were, of course, a lot of other things. Well, not a lot of other things. Let me restate that. A few other things that happened at the convention. I think it would be a gross misstatement to call a lot of other things. I mean, there's so many state conventions, it seems like, sometimes that you start to wonder as a reporter how many news stories you can kind of squeeze out of that thing.
Yeah, conventions by definition are typically news-free, although there are promises that August in Denver, the national convention, might be different this
year. That could be different. And that's the crux of the other big story from the state party convention. Former President Bill Clinton showed up to address the delegates on Sunday morning and met privately with a group of superdelegates. And the soundbite heard around the world where he told everybody to chill out.
Yes.
I've seen that soundbite like 14 times, like in 3 hours or something.
Yeah.
But, I mean, clearly he made a presence. The Obama campaign, interestingly enough, did not, you know, Senator Obama didn't show up or his wife didn't show up. But the district attorney from San Francisco, Kamala Harris, did speak for him.
She was the proxy.
She was the proxy.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, and you know, it's interesting, you the feedback you get from some of those folks who listened to Clinton was that it was a soft sell almost, that it wasn't a, you know, come over to our side, come over to Hillary's side. It was a, I mean, is that kind of the read from what you heard?
I think so. The basic take from Clinton was, hey, look, you know, I think there's a lot of unease among Democrats now that this prolonged fight will hurt the nominee in the fall, whoever it is, in their candidacy against John McCain. There's sort of a, you know, Obama is using this kind of inevitability as a justification to sort of seal the deal and a need to kind of accelerate this process to unify the party and take on John McCain in November. And Clinton is basically trying to slow the timeline down. That's kind of the Clinton campaign strategy. And that was his pitch. That was his pitch to delegates this weekend. It wasn't necessarily a strong advocacy for Hillary. It was a sort of an explanation of the process and just to sort of try to calm people down and in hopes of creating a window for his wife to somehow overtake Obama, either in delegates or in the popular vote.
I still don't know, and I have no information on this, as to what prompted him to fly out to San Jose for the convention. I mean, because of all the places that I would think you would want to put his resources, why come back to California unless they think that there's enough superdelegate issues here or enough people right. to make a difference? I mean, in other words, what I'm saying is, I mean, you know, with the limited time that he's got, well, you know, San Jose...
Well, a couple of things. I mean, number one, there was a guaranteed media presence there. You know, all the papers in California were there, and he got a lot of play out of it. Number two is that you alluded to the superdelegates. There were 60-some-odd uncommitted superdelegates still in the California delegation. That's a huge chunk, and they're talking now about some sort of mini-convention of superdelegates, so right. that superdelegates will pick one candidate to throw their support behind. So I think that the superdelegate angle was a big part of the reason for Clinton's appearance. Mm.
Well, as you said, he certainly got a lot of attention for it, that was probably the only real big political story of the last couple of days. Right. So let's come back to the Capitol now, where we had a holiday on Monday, and we're back here at the beginning now, first week of April. No more April Fool's jokes. I'll try not to insult anyone's intelligence with lack of creativity on my part. Several things, you know, just kind of percolating. Obviously, a lot of committees meeting this week. First blush at some different pieces of legislation without going through several hundred of those. One thing that happened last week that you guys wrote about, Anthony, was a few things on the subject of health care. And a bit of a fracas about some healthcare issues and then some discussion in the legislature. But lay it out.
Right. Well, some of this is just picking up the pieces from the disintegration of the comprehensive healthcare reform plan earlier this year. But the Senate Health Committee, the place where the health plan died back in January, held a hearing. Most of it was focused on the Department of Managed Healthcare. They're the regulatory body that oversees HMOs in California.
Under the direction of the governor, under the
right,
part of
right,
the governor's administration.
Right, part of the Business, Transportation, and Housing Agency, if you must.
Nice piece of trivia.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Indeed. and Senator Sheila Kuehl, who has been a strong advocate of single-payer health care and often a critic of the department, brought the director of the department before the committee to try to answer some questions. And number one, perhaps the most hot-button issue now is this issue of rescission, where health plans, after patients make big claims, say you're diagnosed with something like cancer, you make your claim, and that sets off an investigation. The HMO investigates your health history, and they find out that on your original questionnaire that you filled out when you applied for health insurance, you somehow left out a piece of information, and suddenly it's grounds for cancellation. And so there's been a lot of these cancellations of policies, sort of what they call post-claims cancellations. And it's been a big issue. The city attorney in Los Angeles is now exploring criminal charges into one HMO down there. And it's getting some attention here. A number of legislators have bills to try to crack down on this practice. And last week was Senator Kuehl and the Health Committee's attempt at sort of trying to bring some of these issues to the forefront.
And I wonder, you know, you know, kind of you said the way you set it up, talking about, you know, last year's healthcare debate and then looking forward to this. It just kind of seems like, you know, in the wake of that debacle of last year, you go back now, and these are not to say that these are not important issues, but you go back to individual issues. You go back to individual problems and issues within, under the umbrella of healthcare problems.
Right.
And because the whole enchilada was just too much. It was just, you know, and so now we really are focused on pieces of this.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, it's kind of the world war may be over, but this tribal warfare has broken out everywhere. And these are the old fights that are again rearing their heads. I mean, this fight, this whole issue of rescission would have gone away under a universal health care plan because everybody would have been required to carry health insurance, and health insurers would not be able to prohibit anyone from getting coverage. So that would have eliminated this issue of people being dumped from their health insurance policies. It's just one example of, I mean, there are 20 others of all the little battles that they tried to roll into this large comprehensive health care reform last year. And these battles will be back in the legislature one by one.
And I think, again, it's fascinating to think about the way that you and I and a lot of people know politics works, which is that, you know, you can analyze things one of two ways. You put everything in one omnibus bill or proposal, and you therefore say, well, these things are too hard to do individually, so we'll put them all together. That's the only way we'll get them done. Right. Conversely, you can look at an omnibus proposal and say, well, everybody hates it because there's something everybody hates in it, and it'll go down.
Right.
And in different times and different issues, both either one of those will prove true.
Right.
You know, and one of those maxims will actually work. And
the issue is so complicated. I mean, what makes the issue of rescission so interesting is it's something that people can really understand. I mean, you're sick.
Yeah.
You think you have health insurance. You've been paying your health insurance all this time. You're sick, and then you want to collect on your health insurance finally, and they say only then do they say, oh, no, oops, sorry, you didn't tell us about the head cold you had in the fourth grade.
And all of a sudden you're out, right?
Yeah, you're out. And in a lot of cases, not only are you out, but the claim is that not only is your health insurance canceled, but it's that you've never had health insurance. So oftentimes these health insurance companies file counterclaims and receive large judgments saying, hey, look, all this treatment you got when you were diagnosed with cancer, you had the initial biopsy, you started your radiation treatment, we're not going to pay for that because this contract is null and void. So not only are you sick, not only do you not have health care, not only are you not insurable going forward, but you also owe us $150,000.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a sensitive issue. I think a lot of politicians understand the kind of the simplicity and the, you know, the ease with which people can understand this issue. And I think a lot of people are beginning to seize on it now.
Well, as that issue continues to move its way through and different things on the issue of healthcare, the other issue that, of course, we spend a lot of time talking about these days here at the state capitol in Sacramento is the state budget and the crisis of the state budget. And we've got various budget discussions taking place this week in committee. We have some subcommittees dealing with things, education issues, full budget issues, some in the legislature this week. I think a lot of people would certainly see that April kind of is the beginning of the real rush up to really dealing with budget issues.
Right.
And we'll talk about some of these in the weeks to come about revenues that come in and things like that. But that, you know, the dynamic really hasn't changed much in the last couple of weeks, has it? I mean, it's kind of where it has been. It's kind of been, for lack of a better term, it's been kind of in neutral for a little while here about the dynamic and the debate and the rhetoric even.
Yeah, I think that's fair. There's been no breakthrough on whether or not, on the fundamental issues, on whether there should be an increase in revenue, some sort of tax or comprehensive fee increase proposal, or whether there should be deeper cuts. I mean, those discussions have not moved in any way that I don't think any of us who watch this stuff can recognize any movement there. I think they're just sort of treading water a little bit and waiting to see what the numbers are, which we'll talk about in the weeks to come as actual tax receipts begin to roll in.
The one thing that has happened and the one thing that is going on is Governor Schwarzenegger has been doing these well-publicized and well-choreographed little events around the state where he's gone and talked about the budget, both about the budget crisis this year and about the need for reforming the budget process. And I did a piece last week that tried to answer a simple question, which is, where is the governor's budget reform proposal? Now, some of you may remember that the governor mentioned it in the State of the State speech in January, that he wanted to come back to this issue. Some of you, of course, may know that I say back to the issue because this is at least the third time that the governor has talked about budget reform. And one time, most specifically, was Proposition 76 on the 2005 ballot, where he got overwhelmingly
kicked in the teeth.
Yeah, okay. I mean,
your corporal punishment.
Yes, but that was a budget reform proposal that went absolutely nowhere, and so now he's come back to the issue. He laid it out, as I said, in the State of the State in January. He laid out a series of ideas, a framework, a general understanding of it. And that's where we still are here at the beginning of April. There is no formal piece of legislation as a proposed constitutional amendment. And the administration's argument largely has been, well, people know what we're talking about by the framework. They understand what we're doing with the framework. And that's fair enough to a point. But also at a point, I know, Anthony, you certainly know, too, that details matter in the Capitol. And details are really what people need to see where they're going to come down on this. And the details are what killed Proposition 76 in 2005.
Right.
And the way it impacted education funding and, you know, the broad powers it would give the governor to cut the budget on his own to resolve a deficit. And this one appears to do something similar to that. Mm-hmm. And I think until he's got the details, it's very difficult to hear him go down, you know, through different parts of the state and talk about somebody needs to pass my budget reform plan or get on it. Well, where is it?
Well, and this is indicative of the way that this governor operates. I mean, we saw the same thing with health care. We didn't see a plan amended or introduced into bill form until the special session was called, which was in the fall. It was the fall. But this is sort of how this governor works. And I think part of the reason is because of his relationship with legislative Republicans. I'm not sure he could get a bill introduced with his name on it, with a sponsor.
Because of the animosity the animosity legislative Republicans feel for him.
I think that's part of it. I do think it's just a negotiating style as well. You can arguably say the governor remains in a stronger negotiating position in terms of being able to make his case to the public without the problem of these sticky little details to burden him and slow him down. I mean, look, these deals get worked out on the staff level and between a couple of legislators anyway. Why go through the pain and suffering of having these details when, you know, it's just going to get ripped apart? It will be fodder for all of the opponents, you know, whether it be the teachers' unions or other budget stakeholders who have a lot to lose with anything that would rein in state spending. And I don't know if this reform is going to be part of this year's budget process?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, are they attached when you go into negotiations over this budget? Is it a this and a that?
Right. And who's making the deal? Is it the termed out, you know, as we talked about last week, is it these three lame duck leaders? Or is it going to be the three new leaders, you know, three new legislative leaders, two in the Senate and the new Speaker of the Assembly making this deal?
Well, I have a tremendously hard time seeing how this budget reform proposal would move forward, even with the framework. And I'll tell you why. I mean, and actually, it's very simple why people
because
who watch
you've been
this,
here for more than 6 weeks.
Yeah,
and you
just
know
barely.
How this place works.
Just barely. Yeah, as a veteran member of the Capitol Press Corps after 5-6 years.
Grizzled.
Grizzled. No, but I mean, you know, the fundamental problem, you know, and just even doing the story that I did, is that Democrats appear to still be very, very leery of giving the governor the power to make budget decisions on his own in a fiscal crisis.
Right.
You know, the framework as it's laid out says essentially that the legislature would get the first crack at it. The legislature would get a shot to deal with the problem first, kind of almost like this thing we went through with the fiscal emergency declaration that was made. Legislature gets the first crack. If they don't do something by, and again, this is all fuzzy, some amount of time, not
right.
specified quite yet, the governor gets to make cuts to a certain point on his own unilaterally. Well, in talking to Daryl Steinberg, the incoming pro tem of the state Senate for the piece last week, he said it's not the right plan. You don't give the executive that kind of power. And I think if that's the problem, that's a stumbling block you can't overcome. I mean, because...
Right.
That's, you know, the governor's ideas on budget reform have always been centered around the fact that he should have some ability to make changes to spending on his own if nobody will.
Well, and part of the problem is the deadlock. I mean, you know, you can take this out to in a different direction and say, well, maybe the problem is that we have a two-thirds vote requirement for the budget. And many people have advocated eliminating that two-thirds vote requirement, maybe making the budget a simple majority vote, and maybe somehow breaking out revenue increases. Even Republicans like Tom McClintock have advocated eliminating the two-thirds requirement for the budget specifically. But, you know, these problems are not new to California, and we've seen, you know, so many efforts, whether it be from politicians or outside groups or, you know, foundations or academics trying to tackle these systemic problems. And we saw another one unveiled last week.
Another good transition.
See how seamless that was?
You're getting good at this.
If you hadn't called it out, nobody would have noticed.
Several months of this, and Anthony York has become a broadcast aficionado. Go ahead. Yeah. Speaking of outside groups.
Well, this new group, California Forward, has received major foundation funding from, I think it was, do you remember the dollar figure? Was it $13 million?
You're on your own on that one.
From five foundations who have expressed an interest in reforming, in systemic reform in California politics, and they've called into service some of the most well respected and familiar names in California politics, among the sort of thoughtful approach set, the quasi academic set, people like former White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta, who's heading this new effort, and they're going to try to diagnose and solve some of these systemic problems. This is not a new idea. I mean, we've seen groups like this try and fail in the past.
Well, and that's the problem. We have seen a lot of these efforts before, and that's not to undercut what these folks are going to do, but...
And a lot of the same people are involved. I mean, former Senator Charles Puccigian, and a former member of the Little Hoover Commission, who looked at this stuff routinely as a member of that commission, and the last big effort... the governor's California performance review. Remember that?
Large phone book size package of reforms that went nowhere.
Right, and it went nowhere via the Little Hoover Commission. Bill Houck, who's you know long been involved in all sorts of efforts to try to reform California state governance, is involved in this group. He's been involved in, was it the legislative analyst that came in with a sort of a constitutional review commission a few years back. What makes this group a little bit different and sort of offers a ray of hope for people who want to see some changes is that they're not just going to be drafting white papers to be discarded, you know, like your Capital Weekly somewhere. They're actually creating a 501c4, a political arm, and they're going to be political players. They're going to be raising money and getting involved in political campaigns. I would hazard a guess. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that they're going to get involved in this redistricting initiative that will be on the November ballot, supported by the governor and Steve Wesley. And we'll see what other kinds of things they get behind, whether it's lowering the vote threshold for the budget or making it easier to raise taxes or somehow modifying Proposition 13 or Proposition 98, some of these sort of taxing, right, these formulaic mechanisms that lock in the state's ability to either raise revenues or spend money or make budget cuts. We'll see how deep they go and how successful they are.
Well, and you know, and I was just sitting here thinking, and I have not thought this out, so this is a full disclaimer before I just throw out a random piece of brain power on a morning of the beginning of the week. But I'll be very curious to see what this group's ideas and proposals and push is and compare it to the opinion of the governor on these issues.
Right.
And I tell you for one reason specifically, because a lot of people wonder what Arnold Schwarzenegger will do when he leaves office. You know, he is prohibited from running for president. You know, a lot of people say, does he want to be in the U.S. Senate or not? And I tend to think I tend to be skeptical of that idea. You know, I can see Arnold Schwarzenegger more as a person who wants to get involved, wants to find his projects, wants to find his issues, wants to push ballot measures, whatever it would be. And I can see a group like this being, in other words, I can see, you know, an Arnold Schwarzenegger ex-governor being interested in working with a group, you know, a group of reform-minded people to deal with things he couldn't do as governor. And I'm not saying that Arnold's going to join on with these folks in 2 years' time or that they'll be around in 2 years' time. No offense to them again, but we have seen a lot of these efforts before. But I'll be very curious to see what kinds of things they come forward with, his reaction to them, and what is the, for lack of a better term, the status of the ongoing effort to reform California's systemic problems.
And the problem is with a lot of this stuff is that these are not kitchen table issues. While they may, you know, I mean, these are not sexy issues. Nobody's sitting around their table talking about redistricting or vote thresholds for state budgets.
Well, and this is almost a tough time to deal with them, given the economic pressures that a lot of Californians are facing.
But, you know, there's an argument to be made that this is the perfect time, and you hear that made. These are not the things that are going to get people excited and motivated politically. And so the trick is, how do you push these reforms in a world where, you have very entrenched interests on both sides in maintaining portions of the status quo, which is what makes it so difficult to maneuver. And so how do you fight this kind of inside game with outside money and try to make it appealing and digestible and interesting to the world at large? It's challenging.
I mean, inside outside. I like that.
Yeah, it's
basketball metaphor.
Well, you know, it's Final Four time.
Yeah.
And you're in North Carolina. Oh, but you're a Duke fan. We could talk about that if you'd like.
I'm a Duke alum, actually, and I prefer not to talk about the debacle of that. But you're right.
The good news is you beat Belmont, right?
Wow. Hurt a guy. Long story short, I think this is an interesting one to watch. I think that's probably what we should say. It'd be interesting to see how they do it, what they come out with out of the gate first. How big is their bipartisan consortium of people behind it? And as you said at the beginning, and I think this is really important, given that they will be able to be politically active, where do they put their money?
Right.
And how much money do they have to put behind it?
And how do they spend it? I mean, you know, if they take a sort of academic approach to this stuff, and get involved with mission statements and talk about the need for structural reform, I mean, you can spend $1 trillion. I'm not sure you're going to move anybody into action.
And also the opinions of the new chairman of the commission, Ben Affleck.
Right. Ben Affleck. We've come full circle.
Full circle to my bad April Fool's jokes. Oh, I couldn't even pull
you
Anthony
promised,
on that one.
You promised our listeners. Both of them.
Both of them. We used to have 8, then 6, then 4. Now, both of them.
It's like basketball.
One of them is my mom back in North Carolina.
Hi, Mom.
Mom, I'll see you in a couple weeks. That'll do it for this all-over-the-place edition of the Capital Notes podcast. For Anthony York, I'm John Myers. We'll see you next time.